Lecture 4 of The Foundations of Human Experience by Rudolf Steiner. This is the synopsis for Lecture 4. Feeling in relationship to willing. The 9 aspects of the human being as a willing being. The expression of will as instinct in the physical body, drive in the etheric body, desire in the astral body. The absorption of will into the I, capital, as motive in the soul, as wish in spirit self, intent in life spirit, and decision in spirit human. Psychoanalysis seeks the unconscious willing of the quote-unquote second person in us. Intellectualism as will grown old, and feeling as developing will. Concerning socialist education. The formation of feeling and will in education. Cultivation of feeling through unconscious repetition and cultivation of the will and strengthening the power of decision through conscious repetition. The importance of artistic activity in this connection. End of synopsis. Lecture 4 given in Stuttgart, August 25th, 1919. If you recall what I said yesterday in my semi-public lecture, you will understand that in the future teachers must place special value upon forming will and feeling. I said yesterday that even those who do not think in terms of a renewal of education also stress the importance of developing will and feeling. However, in spite of all their goodwill, those people accomplish little that develops will and feeling. Will and feeling are left more and more to chance because there is no insight into the true nature of willing. To begin with, I would like to note that only when we really understand the will can we understand even a part of the feeling that moves us. To begin with, I would like to note that only when we really understand the will can we understand even a part of the feelings that move us. Thus we can ask ourselves, quote, what is a feeling, really? Unquote. A feeling is closely related to will. Will is only feeling made active, and feeling is repressed will. That part of will that we do not completely express and that remains in the soul is feeling. Feeling is blunted will. Thus we can first understand the nature of feeling only when we have penetrated the nature of willing. You can see from my explanation up to this point that during life between birth and death, we do not completely form everything that lives in the will. When we carry out a deed of will, there always remains something that is not expended in life before dying. Something of every willed decision and every willed deed remains in the human being and lives on through death. We must take this remainder into account throughout life, particularly in childhood. We know that when we look at the complete human being, we see the human body, soul, and spirit. The body, at least in its coarser constituents, is born. You can find more details concerning this in my book, Theosophy, again, which is on my website, by the way. The body is part of the stream of genetic heredity. It carries inherited traits and so forth. The soul is that part of prenatal existence most closely connected to the body. However, what is spiritual in modern human beings exists only as a tendency. In human beings in a distant future it will be different. So here, where we wish to lay the foundation for a good pedagogy, we must take into account what is present only as a spiritual tendency in human beings of the present developmental era. We should be very clear about which human tendencies are present for a distant human future. What we call spirit self is present only as a tendency. We cannot immediately include spirit self as a part of human nature when we speak of modern human beings. Nevertheless, a clear awareness of spirit self is present in people capable of seeing what is spiritual. They know that the entire Oriental consciousness, insofar as it is a developed consciousness, calls spirit self manas, and that in Oriental culture, manas is spoken of as something living within human beings. also Occidental peoples who have not been completely, quote-unquote, educated, have a clear awareness of spirit self. I can say without reserve that a clear awareness is present because common people, at least before they came completely under the control of a materialistic attitude, called what remained of a human being after death the, quote-unquote, manes, M-A-N-E-S. People say that what remains after death is the manes. Manas equals manes. As I said, common people have a clear consciousness of this, because in this case they use the plural, the manes. Since, in anthroposophy, we connect spirit self more closely with the human being before death, we use the singular, spirit self. Common people, since they speak more out of reality and more out of a naive understanding of spirit self, use the plural in speaking of the manes, because at the moment a person goes through the gates of death, a number of spiritual beings receive him or her. I have already mentioned in another context that we each have our personal spiritual guide who is a member of the hierarchy of angels, and that, standing above that, are the spirits of the archangelic hierarchy who become active when we go through the gates of death. Thus we immediately have an existence in relationship to many, because many of the archangels are active in our existence. Common people feel this quite clearly because they know that the human being, in contrast to the apparently individual existence here on earth, can then be perceived as a plurality. Thus the manes is something that lives in the naive collective consciousness about the plurality of spirit self, of manas. Then there is a second higher aspect of the human being that we call life spirit. The life spirit is barely perceptible in modern human beings. It is something very spiritual that will develop in the distant future. The highest part of the human being is something that presently exists only as a barely perceptible tendency, the actual spirit human. Even though these three higher parts of human nature exist only as tendencies in modern human life between birth and death, they undergo an important development between death and rebirth, of course under the protection of higher spiritual beings. When a human being dies and again becomes accustomed to life in the spiritual world, these three aspects develop quite clearly in a manner that points to a future human existence. Just as the human being develops the spirit soul during life between birth and death, in the same manner there is a clear development after death. Only then the human being is connected to spiritual beings of the higher hierarchies by something akin to an umbilical cord. Let us now add to those barely perceptible higher portions of human nature what we can already perceive, namely what the consciousness soul, the comprehension soul, and the sentient soul express. These are the actual components of the human soul. Today, if we wish to speak about the human soul and how it lives in the body, we must speak about these three aspects. If we wish to speak about the human body, we must speak of the sentient body, parenthesis, the least perceptible body, which we also call the astral body, parenthesis, the etheric body, and the coarse physical body, which we can see with our eyes and which conventional science dissects. Thus we have before us the complete human being. Now you know that we bear a physical body in common with the animals. Only when we compare the nine aspects of the human being with the animal world do we arrive at a feeling and an idea of the relationship of people to animals useful for comprehending the will. That is, we are able to comprehend the will only when we know that just as the human soul is clothed with a physical body, animals are also clothed with a physical body. However, in many respects, the physical body of animals is formed differently from that of the human being. The human physical body is not nearer perfection than is that of the animal. Consider, for example, the beaver and how it forms its lodge. Humans cannot do that if they have not studied, if in fact they have not gone through a very complicated schooling and learned architecture and so forth. The beaver builds its lodge out of the function of its body. Its physical body is formed to fit into the physical world such that the beaver can use what lives in the form of this body to create its lodge. In this connection, the beaver's physical body is its schoolmaster. We can also find in the form of the physical bodies of wasps, bees, and other lower animals something that is not present in the human physical body to so great an extent or with such strength. All this is what we encompass with the concept of instinct. We can only study instinct when we see it in relation to the form of the physical body. If we study the entire animal world and how it spreads itself before us, everywhere we will find a guide for the study of the various kinds of instinct in the physical forms of animals. If we wish to study the will, we must seek it first in the realm of instinct, and we must be conscious that we will find instinct in the various animal forms. If we were to look at and sketch the major forms of individual animals, we would be able to sketch the different areas of instinct. The physical bodies of different animals form a picture of what exists as instinct in the will. When we accept this point of view, we can make some sense of the world. We can look at the forms of the animal bodies and see in them symbols created by nature of the instincts it desires to be real and living. The etheric body lives in our physical body, completely forming and permeating it. However, it is beyond imperceptible to the external senses. When we look at the nature of will, we see that the etheric body takes hold of what is physically expressed as instincts in the same way that it permeates the physical body. Instinct, then, becomes a drive. Will is instinct in the physical body, but when the etheric body begins to control instinct, will becomes a drive. It is quite interesting to see how instinct, that is completely visible in external forms, becomes more inward and more unified when we consider it to be a drive. We always speak of instinct, whether we find it in animals or in a weakened form in human beings, as something forced upon the being from outside. When we think of drives, we must remember that because the supersensible etheric body has taken control of instinct, that expression comes more from within. Instinct thus becomes a drive. The human being also has a sentient body that lies deeper still. When it takes hold of a drive, not only does the drive become internal, let me read that again. When it takes hold of a drive, not only does the drive become internal, but instinct and drive are raised to consciousness, resulting in desire. Just as we find drives in animals, we also find desires, because animals have all three of these bodies, the physical, the etheric, and the sentient or astral. However, when you speak of a desire, you will quite instinctively view desire as something inner. When you speak of a drive, you speak of something expressed uniformly during the entire time from birth until old age. When you speak of desire, you speak of something created by the soul, a momentary creation. A desire need not be a characteristic, it need not adhere to the soul, rather it arises, then fades away. Thus we can see desires as something more closely connected with the soul than simple drives. Now we may ask what occurs when a human being draws what lives in the temporal body as instinct, drive, and desire into his or her I, capital I, that is, into the sentient soul, the comprehension soul, and the consciousness soul. Parenthesis, this is something that cannot occur in animals. Parenthesis. Here we cannot differentiate quite so clearly as we were able to do in the temporal body, because in the soul of modern human beings, everything is all mixed up. The problem in modern psychology is that psychologists do not know whether they should strictly separate the aspects of the soul or whether they should allow them to flow into one another. The old strict differentiation between will, feeling, and thinking plays a role in certain schools of psychology. In some, for example, those tending toward the Herbartian view, everything tends more toward the direction of thinking, and in others, such as the Wundtian school, more toward the will. There is no firm idea about what we can do with the various soul aspects, because in practical life the I, capital, permeates all aspects of the soul in modern human beings, so that the three aspects of the soul are not readily apparent. Thus there are no words to differentiate between what exists when will is taken over by the soul, by the I, and aspects of will that exist as instinct, drive, and desire. Generally speaking, however, we refer to instinct, drive, and desire when influenced by the I as motive. So when we speak of the will impulses in the soul and in the I, we speak of motives and know that although animals can have desires, they can have no motives. In human beings, a desire first arises by being brought into the soul, creating a strong incentive to inwardly understand a motive. Only in human beings do desires become motives of will. Human beings have instincts, drives, and desires in common with the animal world, but only humans can raise these to a motive. Thus we have what is present as will in modern human beings. It quite clearly exists, and anyone who observes human beings at all will say concerning the nature of human will that to understand someone is to know what motivates that person. But not quite. Something quite subtle occurs when someone develops motives, and we must carefully and with all acumen take this subtlety into account. You need to differentiate clearly what I mean by this subtlety in the will impulse from what is more a thought. I do not mean what is thought-like in the will impulse. You can, for example, think, quote, what I wanted or did was good, unquote, or you could have some other idea. I do not mean that. What I mean is something that touches the will quite subtly. Even if you have motives, there is something that still acts upon the will, namely the wish. I do not mean the strongly formed wishes from which we form desires, but those subtle wishes that accompany all of our motives. They are always present. We are particularly aware of these wishes when we do something that arises out of a motive in our will, and then think about it and say to ourselves, quote, what you have just done, you could have done much better, unquote. However, is there anything in life of which we could not say that we could have done it better? It would be sad if there were anything with which we could be completely satisfied, because there is nothing we could not do better. The difference between a person standing higher and one standing lower in life is precisely that the latter always desires to be satisfied with himself. The person standing higher in life is never completely satisfied, because the subtle wish to do better, even to do things differently, always exists as a motive. This is an area that is often misunderstood. People see something great when they regret a deed. However, that is not the best we can do with a deed, because we often base our regret in egotism. Namely, people desire to have done the deed better, to be better people. That is egotistical. Our striving will be without egotism only when we cease to desire to have done a completed deed better and instead place greater value in doing the same deed better the next time. The intent and the effort to do something better the next time is higher than regret. The wish echoes in this intent, so that we may ask what it is that resounds as a wish. For those who can truly observe the soul, what resounds is the first intimation of everything that remains after death. What we feel is something of this remainder, namely that we should have done better, that we wish we had done better. This form of a wish, as I have just described it, belongs to spirit self. A wish can become clearer and more concrete. It then becomes similar to intent. We can form a kind of idea of how we could do the deed better, should we need to do it again. However, I do not value such pictures very highly, but rather what lies in the realm of feeling and willing that accompanies every motive to do better the next time in a similar situation. Here the so-called human subconscious comes strongly to the fore. In your normal consciousness, you will not always be able to create a picture of how you could do a similar deed better the next time you act out of your will. The other person who lives in you, the second person, always develops a clear picture, parenthesis, not as an idea, but according to will, parenthesis, of how to carry out an action should you again be in the same situation. Do not underestimate this fact. Do not underestimate the second person who lives in you. Today there is much drivel about this second person by the so-called science that calls itself analytic psychology or psychoanalysis. Psychoanalysis introduces itself with some notebook example. I have already mentioned this example, however, we would do well to recall it again. It is the following. Long quote. A man gives a party in his house, and he has planned that immediately after the party his wife will leave for a resort. Numerous people attend the party, among them a particular woman. He gives the party and takes his wife to the train. The party guests, among them the woman, leave to go home. On their way, the guests with the woman are surprised by a carriage rounding the corner of a crossroads just as all the guests arrive there. What do the guests do? Everyone, except the woman, moves to the side of the road to allow the carriage to pass. She runs as fast as she can down the middle of the street in front of the horses. The carriage driver does not stop, and the other guests are very startled. However, the woman runs so quickly that the others cannot follow her, and she continues running until she comes to a bridge. It still does not occur to her to move to one side. She falls in the water, is rescued, and brought back to the home of the host. She can now spend the night there. Unquote. You can find this event given as an example in many You can find this event given as an example in many psychoanalysis textbooks. However, there is something in it that is widely misinterpreted. We must ask ourselves, quote, what is the basis of this whole episode? Unquote. The basis is the willing of the woman. What did she really want? She wanted to return to the host's home after his wife had left because she was in love with him. However, the desire was not a conscious one, but something lying in the subconscious. The subconscious second person living within someone is often more clever than the person. The subconscious was so clever in this particular case that the woman set up the whole process up to the moment she fell into the water in order to return to the host's home. She could even prophetically see that she would be saved. Psychoanalysis attempts to understand these hidden powers of the soul, but speaks only vaguely about a second person. However, we can know that what is active in the subconscious powers of the soul, and often expressed very cleverly, in fact more cleverly than the normal characteristics of the soul, exists in every person. Deep in every person sits another person. In that other person, a better person also lives, a person who always promises to do a completed deed better the next time. Thus, with each deed, there is also a subtle and unconscious, a subconscious intent to do the deed better in the next similar situation. When we free the soul from the body, intent becomes decision. The intent lies like a seed in the soul. The decision comes later. Decision occurs in spirit human, just as intent exists in life spirit, and the pure wish in spirit self. If you look at the human as a willing being, you will find all of these elements, instinct, drive, desire, and motive, and also more subtly, what lives in spirit self, life spirit, and spirit human, as wish, intent, and decision. This has tremendous importance for human development. What lives quietly, while preserving itself for the time after death, is expressed pictorially by people between birth and death. We refer to it with the same words. In our thinking, we also experience wish, intent, and decision. However, we can experience wish, intent, and decision in a way befitting us as human beings only when these things are properly developed in us. What wish, intent, and decision really are in the depths of human nature are not outwardly expressed between birth and death. The pictures occur only in our thoughts. If you only develop the usual kind of consciousness, you cannot at all know what a wish is. You have only thought about the wish. For this reason, Herbart believes that striving is already present in the idea of the wish. It is the same with intent. Here also, you have only the thought. You want to do such and such, that is something real, playing out in the depths of your soul, but you do not know the reason. Now we come to decision. Who knows anything about this? Psychology normally speaks only about some general desire. In spite of all this, the teacher must touch all three of these forces of the soul to regulate and order them. We must work with just what occurs in the depths of human nature when we wish to work in education. And again, a little picture of these ideas in a schematic form, a left column and a right column, and matched together, we have spirit human, decision, life spirit, intent, spirit self, wish. And then combined in consciousness soul, comprehension soul, sentient soul, we have motive. And then we have sentient astral body, desire, ether body, drive, physical body, instinct. It is particularly important that as teachers we are aware that it is insufficient to form education according to common practice. We must form education based upon a true understanding of the inner human being. Popular socialism makes exactly this mistake, namely of attempting to form education according to common practice. Think for a moment about how it would be if we based future education on the usual ideals of the Marxist socialists. This has already occurred in Russia, and because of that, the Lunacharsky school reform is something terrible. It is the death of all civilization. Though many horrible things result from Bolshevism, the worst of these will be the Bolshevik teaching method. If it were victorious, then it would destroy everything that has come into civilization from earlier times. This would not happen immediately with the first generation, but certainly with the coming generations, and thus all civilization would soon disappear from the face of the earth. Some people must have already seen this. Recall that we now live under the dilettantish demands of moderate socialism. Socialism already tends toward this upside-down view. It mixes the good together with the bad. In this very room you have already heard people singing the praises of Bolshevism who have absolutely no idea that through Bolshevism the devil rides straight into socialism. We must be particularly careful here. We need people who know that social progress requires that teachers have an intimate understanding of the human being. We must know that future teachers need a deep inner comprehension of human nature, that they must live with an inner connection to human nature, and that in teaching they may not use the practices common among adults. What do most Marxists desire? They want to create socialist schools. They want to dismantle the principal's office without replacing it, and they want to teach as many children as possible. Only something terrible can result. I was once in a country boarding school, and wanting to observe the teaching of the most high-minded class, the religion class, I entered the classroom. One rascal lay on the windowsill, dangling his feet out the window. A second sat on the floor. A third lay somewhere on his stomach with his head raised. This is how the children were in the room. Then the so-called religion teacher came, and with no particular introduction read a short story by Gottfried Keller. The children accompanied his reading with various noises and distractions. When he was finished, the religion class was over and everyone went outside. During this experience, a picture arose in me that next to this boarding school there was a large sheep pen, and that these children lived only a few steps away. We should not criticize such things too sharply. They arise out of much goodwill, but are a complete misunderstanding of what civilization needs for the future. What do modern people want to achieve with the so-called socialist program? People want to deal with children the same way adults deal with one another. However, that is the worst thing we can do in education. We must be conscious that the child needs to develop quite different strengths in both body and soul than adults need to develop in their relations with one another. Education must work with what lies deep in the soul, otherwise we will not progress. We must therefore ask how education affects the nature of human will. We must seriously address this question. If you recall what I said yesterday, you will remember that I mentioned that all intellectual things are will grown old. They are the will in old age. Thus all normal, rationally motivated instruction, all normal reprimands, and all concepts used in teaching have absolutely no effect upon the school-age child. In short, we may say that feeling is developing, that is, not yet existent, will. Let me read that again. In short, we may say that feeling is developing, that is, not yet existent, will. However, the whole person lives in the will, so that we must take into account the child's unconscious decisions. We must guard against the belief that all those things we believe we have thought out well have any influence upon the child's will. We must ask ourselves how we can influence the child's feeling in a good way. We can do that only when we have repetitive activity. You cannot have the proper effect upon the child's will when you tell the child just once what is right, but only when you allow the child to do something today, tomorrow, and the next day. The proper action does not at all lie in reprimanding the child or giving the child rules of morality, but in guiding the child to something that you believe will awaken a feeling for what is right, and allowing the child to repeat this. You must raise such deeds to habit. The more things remain as unconscious habit, the better it is for the development of feeling. The more the child becomes aware of the need to do deeds out of devotion to repetition, because they should and must be done, the more you elevate these to true will impulses. Thus unconscious repetition cultivates feeling. Fully conscious repetition cultivates the will impulse, because through it the power of decision increases. Having the child consciously repeat things spurs on the power to decide that... Let me read that again. Having the child consciously repeat things spurs on the power to decide that would otherwise remain only in the subconscious. In connection with cultivating the will, we may not take into account what is particularly important in intellectual life. In intellectual life, we tend to emphasize that the better the child understands something, the better our teaching is. We lay particular value upon immediate understanding, upon immediate retention. However, what the child immediately understands and retains does not act upon the feeling and will. Only what the child does repeatedly and sees as the proper thing to do under the given circumstances acts upon feeling and will. Earlier, more patriarchal education used this fact. Things became simply a matter of habit. In all such things done in this manner lies something quite good pedagogically. For instance, why did people say the Lord's Prayer every day? Were people today asked to read the same story every day, they would refuse because it would be much too boring. Modern people have been trained for one-time experiences. Earlier people not only prayed the same prayer every day, but they also had a storybook that they read at least once every week. Thus, they also had much stronger wills than those people who undergo modern education. Cultivation of the will is based in unconscious and conscious repetition. We must take that into account. It is insufficient to say abstractly that we should cultivate the will. When that occurs, people may believe that if they have a good idea about developing the will, and through some subtle method bring this idea to the child, they have done something to develop the child's will. In reality, this is useless. The only result is weak and nervous people in continual need of reprimands. People will have inner strength when we, for example, tell the children to do this and that today and tomorrow and the next day. They will do it out of respect for authority, because they know that in school someone must command. Thus, to give each child some task to do every day, possibly for the whole school year, is something that strongly acts to develop the will. It creates contact between the children, strengthens the authority of the teacher, and brings the children to a repetitive activity that strongly affects the will. Why do artistic activities affect the formation of the will particularly strongly? Because first, practice is based upon repetition. And second, what people receive through artistic activity always gives them joy. People enjoy art again and again, not just the first time. Art has a quality that can excite people not just once, but can time and again directly give them joy. For this reason, we directly connect the artistic element with what we want to achieve in teaching. I want to speak more about that tomorrow. Today I wanted to show how we must form the will quite differently than we develop the intellect. The end of Lecture 4.